Welcome to the Jerusalem Chamber, a collaborative effort between four friends who are pastors as they sit down to discuss the Westminster Confession of Faith. Let's join the discussion.
Westminster Confession of Faith, Chapter 6, Paragraph 2. By this sin, they fell from their original righteousness and communion with God, and so became dead in sin and wholly defiled in all the parts and faculties of soul and body.
I said on three.
Wait,
then, I said
Nathan,
on
you can't
three.
Do that. You can't do that. We do it
you
the same way every time.
I can't count.
I changed the rules.
I can't count in that.
Welcome to another episode of the Jerusalem Chamber. I am Nathan Eshelman, and I will be sitting in Prolocutor Twiss's chair this morning as we look at episode 6.2 of the Westminster Confession of Faith. This is chapter 6, paragraph 2, and we'll jump right in this morning. Brothers, this paragraph deals especially with Adam and Eve. Not giving into the rest of the human race. Is there really enough material in the Bible about the fall's effect on Adam to dedicate a whole paragraph of our confession to it?
Well, it's the estate in which we find ourselves. And it's while whatever the biblical data is, the experiential data is all around us, and it explains why we are the way we are and why everything is the way it is.
I think that this paragraph is succinctly stating the Bible's teaching. So, Nathan, your question is there really enough material in the Bible about the fall's effect on Adam to dedicate it to a whole paragraph of our confession? Yeah, I think there is. I think that we may not see that all, maybe in a sense, in the immediate context of Genesis chapter 3. I think we see elements of it, but we do see as that the reality of what happened to Adam when he sinned, we see that in the greater light of Scripture. And so it may not all be present in full bloom in right there in Genesis, but as we go through the rest of the Scriptures, I think they bear witness to exactly what happened when Adam did fall into sin. So I think there is enough biblical information on this to warrant a paragraph.
So this paragraph isn't just speculative then and sort of putting our theology on the first three chapters of the Scriptures. We actually see the first three chapters of the Scriptures affecting the rest of the Word of
Absolutely.
God.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Foundational.
All right. So this paragraph begins with the words, "by this sin," referring back to paragraph 1. Remind us what the sin was and why it was so heinous.
It was eating of the forbidden fruit that was not, you know, again, inherently wicked in and of itself, but God had established his word regarding the fruit, and we were to live by that bread of his word and not by the fruit that we were so easily enticed by.
You know, I think Nathan or Sean, you earlier pointed us toward some of the definitions that help us get the horror and the tragedy of sin. And I think it's Ralph Venning or it is John Bunyan. I forget which one. Talks about sin as the dare of God's justice, the rape of his mercy, the jeer of his patience, the slight of his power, and the contempt of his love. And that is what makes Adam's sin so heinous. It is just that.
The paragraph has four main consequences of the fall that are listed. What are the four that the paragraph lists? And then a follow-up is, do you think there's anything that the Westminster divines left out as far as a consequence of the fall?
Well, simply, according to the paragraph, it talks about the consequences of sin being the loss of original righteousness, the loss of communion with God, and as well as the loss of life and holiness.
And whether or not the Westminster Confession leaves some things out, I suppose in one sense you might be able to say that it does. This paragraph is not seeking to elaborate on all the misery that accompanies mankind in our sin. But if I could put it this way, I think that it hits upon the immediate consequence of that sin, which, as Sean said, is the fall from original righteousness and communion with God, becoming dead in sin and being wholly defiled in all the parts and faculties of the soul and the body. Now, there are many things in our world that are a consequence of those very things. Whether you want to look at it as a chain of events or as a dominoes effect, whatever might help you, there is, of course, many other things that you can say. So we can say, well, you know, it's because of sin that terrible things like sickness have entered into the world, diseases and cancers. Well, that is true, and that is part of what it means to become dead in sin. You can think of all the misery that accompanies, you know, the soul miseries, whether it's depression and anxiety and issues like that. Well, that is also a result of our fall into sin, but in a sense, it's a consequence of what the confession says here in being wholly defiled in all parts and faculties of the soul and the body. And so the paragraph is not going for an all-embracing definition of the misery that now results from this, but I think it is highlighting primarily the primary things that happened as a result in sin, and that is probably something that is helpful for us to be reminded of. You know, the horror of this fall is seen first and foremost not in cancer, which is a horrible tragedy that strikes many families, but the real horror of what we lost in our fall and in the sin of our first parents is really summarized here: original righteousness and communion with God, becoming dead in sin and being wholly defiled in all parts of soul and body.
They're definitely painting with very large strokes and a very big brush as they're giving this, but we can see experientially immediately the impact of this in very specific ways. How you have Adam going quickly, and we mentioned this in the last episode, but very quickly from, you know, behold, this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, to it's the woman you gave me, Lord, and ultimately blaming the Lord himself. So we see all of the fruits of that, but they're not talking about all of the little low-hanging fruits on this. They're talking about the core of what really shifted in that relationship and that status and that position when we went down the path that we went
down. So you men see these consequences then as maybe the root from which all of these other miseries are going to grow as the human race develops and flourishes throughout the ages.
Yeah, what's stated here is miserable enough, but we don't quite comprehend it until we start experiencing those daily miseries that come.
Yeah, and it also does not speak positively, if you can put it in that way, of the consequences in terms of, you know, God's displeasure and wrath and the miseries of all the miseries of this life. It and so there are other things that we see in terms of what man has suffered in consequence of his rebellion against God. But I think, as Kyle has said, this is a very helpful summary of those initial things lost that we see in Genesis 1, 2, and 3.
Okay, so I'd like to spend maybe the next 20 minutes or so looking at these four and talking about what the divines are talking about here. So the first question: what did the change in original righteousness look like that the paragraph puts forth?
I think we should first understand this, how they're using the word righteous here. They don't mean righteousness as in Adam's perfect law keeping, as much as they mean that he is, he's guiltless, he's blameless, he still is without rebellion and without lawlessness or sin. And so in that sense, he still is under the probationary period. He still needs to fulfill all the law. And we're going to talk about that eventually, obviously, when we get to the covenant of works. But he is not a lawless one. He has the ability to keep the law, to desire to do God's will. He has the ability to please God in his worship, service, and obedience. And so in terms of then to fall from original righteousness, now he internally has a corruption that takes place. He has, according to his status, a guilt upon him, and also he is not able to please God, but has fallen into his displeasure. All of that, I think, comes under, in some sense here, the fall from original righteousness.
Abraham Kuyper has an interesting way of portraying this. He talks about when the captain of a man of war in a naval engagement betrays his king and raises the enemy's flag over the ship, he doesn't actually seek to damage or sink the ship, but he still wants to keep it as efficient for service as possible. And Abraham Kuyper uses that brief illustration to say it's in this way that we need to understand man's fall. That before it, before the fall, he possessed the most exquisite exaltedness of God's creation as one created in the image of God with original righteousness, in which the very impulse of his heart and his soul was always directed toward the aim to exalt God. But reversed by the fall, this human created in the image of God, though the human himself remained, the heart was now directed by an unholy impulse and is always and only directed at an unholy object. As the Apostle Paul says in Romans 1, not only as a result of unrighteousness do they do this, that, and the other, but they become inventors of evil. That by a loss of original righteousness, we've been given over to all unrighteousness that Paul says the wrath of God is being revealed against. And now in our unrighteousness, we seek in all kinds of ways to rebel against God.
So that's your summary of all of Kuyper's theology, right?
Sorry. You're the one that reads him. I don't read him.
4 hours later.
I read him for the cultural engagement, Kyle. You should understand that.
You are a transformational.
That's a slam dunk.
All right. So that's change in original righteousness. The next thing that the paragraph gives is loss of communion. Could you describe that loss of communion with God that Adam and Eve experienced in the fall? So sort of what was their communion of God like, with God like, and then the fall occurs, and what was lost in that communion?
I think looking at the dialogue in Genesis, the Lord would command things, they would comply. Immediately after the fall, you see the game of cat and mouse, they're hiding, there's dishonesty, they're disingenuous, there's partial answers, there's all these things. And so immediately you see that change in the conversation that is part of communion with God, that exchange of command and obedience, all those things. So you begin to see it right away, but then as you see blood sacrifice introduced, as you see the ongoing need for sacrifice, which was at the heart of what exposed Cain's heart as he eventually kills his brother, you just see this breakdown that begins to happen between God and his people.
In his book, The Economy of the Covenants Between God and Man, Herman Witsius, in the opening chapters, paints a wonderful picture of what it means for God to be the highest good, as the one who is worthy of all glory and all honor and all praise, and talks about how the fall into sin made Adam and Eve, and as we'll be getting to, made us incapable of being able to see God as the greatest good. That here Adam and Eve had communed with God in the garden, right? It's a garden of fellowship. They had delighted in his presence and he delighted in theirs. And by sin, making them unable any longer to stand in the presence of God, but also this terrible consequence that they weren't even able to any longer perceive that God is the greatest good, that he is the one that is worthy of all glory, because that communion was shattered by the reality of sin. And we still see that at work in many people today. The inability to perceive God as the greatest glory. And so when we talk about the loss of communion with God, it's even the loss of this apprehension that God is worthy to be communed with.
Yeah, I think it's really important to camp out on this particular consequence of sin, because if we could ask, what is the single greatest loss and consequence of sin, it is this right here, communion with God. And you can imagine Adam hearing God walk in the garden, his approach, and Adam running to God to come and to welcome him and to spend time with him. It's almost like the way that our children do when we come home from a day's work. Or come out of the office, Kyle. And yet, here he hears God coming and he runs to hide himself. You can see Adam, being able to talk with God and open up and ask any question and be able to articulate in, careful and deep ways, what's on his heart and mind. And now he is, just simply blame shifting and, trying to get out from, the trouble that he's in, get out of the trouble he's in. And, you know, the expression, the idea of, walking with God, summarizing in some sense communion, he lost God. And, you know, it's interesting. I've been doing premarital counseling, and we were on the section on communication. And I asked the question, why is communication so important? Why do we communicate? Like, what's our goal? What's our purpose in communication? And probably the central aspect of our communication is to be known and to know another. That's why we communicate, because we want to be known. We want to get our thoughts and our purposes and our opinions to be shared and to be understood. Ultimately, the loss of communion with God is that Adam now has lost knowing God. And it's not accidental then that eternal life is described in a real way as knowing God.
Yeah, that's really helpful, Sean. That's I like how you say that we need to camp out here, that communion with God is really the greatest loss. That puts the glory of God higher than even our own souls or our own salvation. And it's difficult for us to think in those categories, or at least to experientially move in those categories, but we know that biblically that ought to be where we see the greatest effect of the fall. The confession goes on to say that Adam and Eve became dead in sin. How can we say that they were dead in sin if they went on to live for hundreds of years? What's going on here?
The death sentence had been enacted, just because it takes a while to come out. doesn't mean that it isn't real. Think of the cry when someone's moving to capital punishment, dead man walking. They're already declaring him to be dead, even though he's walking down the hall to undergo that punishment. And the death, life began to reek of death everywhere we went, including the death of the animals that needed to be sacrificed. We still weren't eating animals in our diet, but animals were required to die. The blood sacrifice was required, pointing forth to the death of Christ. And even within that, the death of Christ was already hanging over our heads because it had been promised and it had been decreed. So there's lots of death, even though breathing one's last hadn't happened yet. We even see Cain and Abel. Abel died shortly thereafter as his brother murdered him. And that becomes, you know, a testimony that cries out from the ground. So lots of death everywhere that eventually comes to full fruition in folks dying what we would call of old age.
I think it's also important to, as Joel is saying, that there's lots of death, to distinguish between physical death and spiritual death. There was an immediate death that took place, not only a guilt that hung over Adam's head, but also an internal corruption. Immediately, they were ashamed of being naked. Why? They were ashamed of being exposed. There was something now to hide. And so it was clear that Adam understood, he experientially understood that he was dead in his sins and trespasses, in his rebellion against God. It's also interesting that then the idea of physical death gets wrapped up in some sense in the midst of the curses that are declared upon Adam and Eve. And, you know, not only are you going to fight against this soil for your next meal, but you're going to return to the dust from which you came. And so physical death was, as Joel said, this cursed sentence that hung over his head. He's a dead man walking, and eventually he's going to go back to the ground.
I think, too, it's probably somewhat helpful to remember the emphasis. It was in Genesis 2:17 where God set forth a prohibition and said, you know, in most of our modern translations, in the day that you eat of it, you will surely or you will certainly die. But the idiom that actually expresses that is a little more interesting in some ways than normal English grammar can get it. What is actually being threatened there is in the day that you eat of it, in dying, you will die. Or even more specific, you will die dying. That's a very potent statement that personally I can hardly wrap my mind and heart around. But it's really bringing out the reality of what this death is. It's not just that death is this terminus at the end of life that we're all barreling toward, which we are, but there's more to that. It is that we will die in dying. That really begins to show forth all of the misery of life. All of this life is tending towards death. Yes, we are born and we are living, but in a real sense, as a result of sin, humanity is dying in death. So I think that's important to see the way that even that is worded and emphasized, so that when we come to the confession and we read that they became dead in sin, this is something that is now characteristic. This is something that now everything about the life of sinners is defined by. We are in dying, we are dying.
And while that's a consequence of sin, I like to point out that it's also a very unnatural aspect to God's creation. God did not create anything to die in and of itself. Death has been brought on because of our rebellion. And so, you know, as you're saying, Kyle, you know, this is not just a natural process at the end of our lives. Sometimes we do these things to try and water down or take away the sting of death. But the only thing that takes away the sting of death is Christ himself.
So when the paragraph says that Adam and Eve were wholly defiled in faculties and parts of soul and body, what's it talking about here?
Is that no part of us is left unkissed by sin and death. There's not a part of our soul that can gather up the gumption to choose Christ on its own. There's no part of our physical bodies that can ultimately overcome the death that has been marked out for us if the Lord tarries. Every single part of us, it doesn't mean that we are as bad as we can be all the time, but all the time, even in quote-unquote good things that we do, there are still evils and little wickedness hiding in that. You know, I'm a little outspoken, I'm a little outgoing, so if I'm in the grocery store and a guy's ahead of me with a bouquet of flowers that he just grabbed out of the, you know, out of the flower department, I'll just look at him and say, huh, what did you do wrong? And he always seems to know what I mean. That we tend to want to do nice things to try to cover our tracks. That even the good and kind things that we do for our spouses, for our children, is kissed by this element of sin and death. That we're not always just doing it because we're just naturally wanting to be kind to them. Many times, if we haven't done something wrong that we're making up for, we're expecting something nice in return for what we are doing for others. It's everywhere. It's all around us. It's who we are, and it's how we operate.
Yeah, I think it's it might be helpful to also talk about all the parts and faculties that are defiled. And notice here, it's not just the faculties and parts of the soul, but parts of the body as well. So that you know, the heart is fallen, and the conscience is fallen, and the mind that thinks our thoughts is fallen. Our emotions are fallen and corrupted by sin, and our will and our desire and even our worship, which is often given to idolatry. We are creatures in the fall that still desire to worship and to live for and to serve. And yet, because we cannot approach this God in our fallen nature, we give that to idols. Our bodies are frail and weak, and we deteriorate over time. There's it's a very descriptive passage. It's a descriptive passage in Ecclesiastes 12 that talks about the failing of the body and the parts of the body. And so every part of us has been affected, has been touched by the fall.
Yeah, I think it's specifically referring to the corruption that was the result of all of this with Adam and Eve, as both Joel and Sean have pointed out. But I would also say, and we're going to get into the development of this, but I think that this corruption that now is true of Adam and Eve is, if I can put it this way, becomes the fountainhead or the wellspring of what we often call original sin or original corruption. This is the spring from which our moral and ethical corruption in body and soul is passed down to us. So I would say, in a sense, that the confession is setting the stage for our understanding of what original sin is.
Well, Sean, Kyle, and Joel, it was good being with you men in the Jerusalem Chamber today. Hopefully that was a helpful discussion for our listeners. I would like to remind our listeners that they can send in questions on Chapter 6, and Kyle can tell them how to do that. This marks the end of another paragraph of the confession as we continue to work our way towards those closing words that say, "Come, Lord Jesus, come quickly. Amen."
Thank you for tuning into the Jerusalem Chamber. to become a full subscriptionist, be sure to head on over to iTunes and subscribe to this podcast. Or visit us online at www.jerusalemchamber.com. Emails can be sent to thejerusalemchamber@gmail.com. The Jerusalem Chamber is copyrighted 2017.